We're gearing up for another installment of The Optimistic Investor, the podcast that takes the often dry and uncomfortable discussion of money, investing, and retirement planning and makes it palatable, interesting, and relevant. The Optimistic Investor is sponsored by InTrack Investment Management with offices in Burlington and Norwich, Vermont. Stay with us. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us today for another episode of The Optimistic Investor. As always, The Optimistic Investor is coming to you from the great state of Vermont, where we are surrounded on four sides by New York State, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Canada. And we love them all, and Montreal is very close. As always, again, we're happy to be joined by the managing partner of InTrack Investment Management, Myron Sofer. Hi, Myron.
Hi, how are you, Dan?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much. How's everything up in Vermont?
Fine. Yeah, I had to wear my winter coat over the weekend. Other than that, you know, it's almost boating weather today.
That's right. Yeah, we're getting closer. It seems to go up and down. The environment is really wreaking havoc, not only on all things around the planet, but our social lives and boating and all that stuff, too. We're also very excited today to have Tom Paris joining us. Tom's the president of iSciences based in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Tom.
Good morning or afternoon.
Yes. Yep. It is afternoon. Depending on where you are, that's afternoon for us. And for our friends out on the West Coast, of course, it's about 11 o'clock in the morning. It's great to have you joining us today. Myron, you and Tom have met just recently. And how did that happen?
Well, try to look around in the local community for things that are of interest to the public in general. I call these entities unsung heroes because there's so many interesting firms that have either relocated to Vermont or have had principal parties relocate to Vermont from other parts of the country. What is very interesting about this, I was interviewing for a new portfolio manager position. And I interviewed a wonderful person who worked for the state of Vermont. And in the discussion with her, I found out that her husband worked for iSciences. So curiosity got me, and I looked up iSciences, and I looked at it, and I said, I can't believe this. I have not called this firm yet. And I was almost embarrassed. So I got on the phone right away and looked at the website for iSciences, reviewed Tom's bio and called a bunch of folks. And that started the process. And Tom and I had a good lunch downtown in Burlington, and we figured out that we had a lot of things in common. I do a lot of reach out at the University of Vermont. And as everyone knows, I don't play the game of SRI ESG. I've been involved in it since 1992, and I won't get into that. Anybody can go to our website and review it. So that's how I got to meet Tom, and welcome here to do a podcast with us today.
Excellent. And Tom, were you a little surprised to hear from Myron? You probably don't receive calls from people like Myron every day.
I was. It was a very pleasant surprise.
Sure. Yep. And it's also, it's always fun to meet people who are like-minded and people who are very curious, like Myron is, and I'm sure you are too. And when people like that come together, great things happen, great conversations, and you never know where it might lead. Well, it's really great to have you here. I was looking over your website. You do some really interesting things. A lot of it is consulting around water scarcity and how that affects companies and populations and the environment and economics. Can you talk about that a little more?
Absolutely. So iSciences has been in business since 1997. We are what people call a work-for-hire consultancy, and we have four overlapping practice areas that all share the common theme of doing geospatial data analytics over large geographic territories. And so we do work in water and climate, human security. I'll explain all of these a little more depth, corporate sustainability, and satellite remote sensing and related science. So in the water and climate arena, over the surface of the globe, we look at water. We look at it in terms of the water stress, which is the imbalance between what people want to do with water and how much water is available. We look at that historically. We look at it in sort of current terms. And then we try to project it forward over multi-decadal time periods to get a sense of where it's getting better and mostly getting worse. We've done this work for a number of different customers. We started doing this work for U.S. government agencies. We then picked it up again with a large food and beverage company. And most recently, the most visible part of what we're doing here, we've done work with the World Resources Institute, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C. We helped them launch a mapping platform they call Aqueduct for mapping water stress worldwide. And we've worked with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to then look at not sort of these long-term and chronic issues, but how there are floods and droughts and where we expect floods and droughts to emerge over the next 9 months.
It's amazing to read about it. And I've read through your blogs and just some of the data and how things are changing and the various places in the world that are really being affected. I was reading recently about the Po River. It's Italy's longest waterway. It says dropping by as much as 2.7 meters below the zero gauge. And more than 100 towns in the region are rationing water. The level is well below the June average, exacerbated by recent high temperatures and a dearth of winter snow peaks in the Southern Alps. And the effects are devastating in terms of food production and just general water needs of the population.
So when we started working on the climate issue, what we realized is that floods and droughts were going to be the way most people felt the changes that are coming as the result of climate change. And that's why we got into the business of doing this global monitor and forecasting of surface water anomalies, floods and droughts, because we knew that there were going to be more frequent floods and droughts with higher severity and more significant social consequences. So we started this work a little over 10 years ago in this particular domain, and it's really become clear to us that when we have bad years, they're much worse than they have been in my memory.
So the problems grow exponentially over time?
They're certainly growing. They're accelerating. I would say it's getting a sense of the rate of acceleration is a little hard to gauge at this point. But we have good science coming out of the IPCC and others that suggests that it will accelerate dramatically over the next 20 to 30 years.
One of the things that was interesting in our original conversation was the connection between water scarcity and other aspects of climate change. And a lot of folks look at the UN Accords and the various issues that have been outlined and presented. And we look at the Paris Accord, and there are five other European entities that have come forth with climate change objectives as well. But how integrated and how important is water scarcity as it relates to other aspects of climate change?
It's intimately related to other aspects. To the extent that it's embodied in these international agreements, the agreements really focus, broadly speaking, on two main aspects of climate change. Mitigating emissions, which is important and needs to be done, but and there's certainly a water component to that when you think about things like hydropower and other renewable energy. And then the other part is, you know, broadly speaking, adaptation and resilience, which are investments to effectively try to buffer ourselves from the coming changes. And water is one of many aspects that are considered there. I actually don't like the framing of adaptation and resilience. Adaptation sounds marginal, incremental change, and resilience sounds like we're just going to try to harden things to keep them the way they are so we don't have to do more substantial change in the way we go about our business. And what we really need to think of is transformation and how we make significant changes in how we organize ourselves economically to live in a new reality. And to do that, make those changes in as frictionless a way as possible. Change can happen in sort of discontinuous ways that are very uncomfortable to live through. And so the big challenge in front of us is engaging in a process of continual transformation that doesn't create outcomes like warfare.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole topic and the connection between water and how we're going to be challenged by this scarcity is so important. And I looked at your technology and your databases that you're discussing, and perhaps you can bring us up to date. So your system, and I don't know if artificial intelligence is involved in it or data mining, but clients can move into your database. They can get registered for it for a fee, I assume, and take your data, no matter where they're located, and utilize that data in terms of perhaps at the impact of their plant on the local water tables. Can you tell us a little more about that aspect of your business?
So what you're talking about is what I call our corporate sustainability practice. And we've built up a large capability, not just the water and climate maps that we've built up and update over time, but other factors of governance, socioeconomic factors, which allow us to place corporate facilities, supply chains, other assets of interest like customers on top of this library of maps. And we provide strategic consulting to get them to turn their heads in the right direction to face the next big surprises, avoid risks, and take advantage of opportunities where they may present themselves. So we characterize where in the world these surprises are likely to occur, what the shape of the surprises are likely to be. And then from there, once you have your heads turned in the right place, the idea is to do more in-depth analysis to understand that particular opportunity or risk in greater detail.
So, you know, what happened recently in China in the last 12 months, not to name companies, but there have been a lot of major corporations that have been impacted in that region of the world. You know, they build these massive manufacturing plants, whether they're in China or India in particular. And I don't know if you're familiar with some of those instances or if you want to kind of comment on what happened in some of those scenarios.
The big crisis that we're still living through now, of course, is COVID. And COVID had dramatic effects on supply chains from both China and India, but specifically China. But to a lesser degree, there's been key flooding events in China that have shut down critical industries above and beyond COVID. One of the features of the new world that we live in is, and it's a feature of climate change more broadly, global environmental change, is that things don't just happen in one place, that they're happening everywhere at once. So you talked about the Po River Valley. We're having significant drought in the Southwest and South America, flooding in Australia, flooding in India. So what happens is as these risks cascade and as they're manifested through a global supply chain, the Russia-Ukraine war has had dramatic impacts on food supply. That's not at least not directly a climate change issue, but now you add a really bad year for climatic shocks on food producers, and these things compound on top of one another and make the coming food year very difficult.
Yeah, that's interesting. And Tom, when I go to your website, perhaps you can tell us a little more, bring us more color to this. You have a number of different maps that are available that strategically show globally different hotspots, different colors based on current stats and perhaps forecasting maps in terms of where some of these issues may impact. And to go back further, which is why I'm such a proponent of connecting the business community with the scientific community in terms of climate change, to understand globally how interconnected some of these hotspots can be, not only from a supply chain standpoint, but just from the normal ability to impact food scarcity on a global basis.
So if you go to our website, what you'll see is every month we produce a report that's captured on the website. We look at global surface water surpluses and deficits. Surpluses is sort of a precursor to flooding, and deficits are droughts. And that we describe the state of the world today and how it's going to evolve over the next 9 months. And we don't do this on our website, but it's a value-added service. Once you know where these problems are, you can put them on top of what other things that you know about the world, like where food is grown for export. So we know that food is grown for export in the United States, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Australia, in India, and that there are large food producers that don't grow for export in China. So we can actually assess the impact of the surface water anomalies on the productivity of the agricultural landscapes in these areas and get a sense of what's happening to the global food supply.
So, for further discussion, this seems like an awful lot of data that you must be crunching. And I read a book not too long ago. I won't mention the name of it, but some folks in our government were having individuals come in on subcommittees, and they were involved on the side with weather forecasting. And isn't it interesting that the weather forecasting did not really come from the firms involved, but from the federal government itself, where you and I as taxpayers have been paying the freight for this data to be collected for the last 80 years. And, obviously you don't have your own satellites circling the globe. So I'm assuming, without you divulging confidential information, that you're utilizing many existing resources across the globe. I don't need to know where it's coming from. I can guess, but it's the way you're capturing and using the data appropriately, and sifting through the data in a consequential way to deliver understandable information to the public.
So the phrase we use is translational science.
I love it.
So you're absolutely right. We start with seasonal forecasts issued by NOAA and their counterpart agencies around the world. And we translate those forecasts into surface water anomalies. So those forecasts are about temperature and precipitation, and we translate them into surface water anomalies. By the way, one of our customers is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We support a number of activities at their National Centers for Environmental Information, including work on drought in the U.S. context. So we don't reinvent the wheel, and we don't try to hide the fact that we use NOAA's seasonal forecast capabilities. And we also, Canada has a similar seasonal forecast capability, and the Europeans have one, and we work with the data where it comes from. We don't have particular biases. We want to use the best of breed data, and oftentimes we'll use multiple different sets of forecasts to create what people call an ensemble to get a sense of where they converge or diverge, to get a sense of confidence in those forecasts.
Yeah. You know, just in this brief conversation, Tom, I could go on for a long time on questions, but, you know, I like to ground people in terms of the conversation. And, you know, here we are in little old Burlington, Vermont. Now, how are you even in Vermont?
I first came to Vermont to go to what was then called junior high school at Edmonds. Junior high school in Burlington, Vermont, and I'm a graduate from Burlington High School. And from there, I went my way in the world. So I went to the University of Michigan. I worked as a software engineer for a firm there that does satellite remote sensing. I then got a degree in, my undergraduate degree is in math and computer science. I decided I wanted to complement those technical capabilities with policy. So I got a degree in science, technology, and public policy, and traveled the Boston, Washington, D.C. Corridor for several years of my life. And at some point, I wanted to raise my family in Vermont. So I had opened an iSciences office in Boston and basically brought that office with me back to Burlington. And we're now on College Street.
I love it. You know, again, thank you so much for talking with us today, Tom. We have a rather broad audience, and I won't be surprised that we'll get a number of inquiries in terms of trying not only to understand more about what you do, but how your information can be disseminated to other entities that folks that know us might be able to encourage others to visit your site and to have discussions with you. And, you know, I really appreciate your time today and look forward to developing a larger relationship with you and your firm. And I don't know, Dan, do you have any questions?
Tom, I'm curious. Do you think that the general population has an idea about water scarcity? I mean, we hear about it on occasion, but it's not something that, you know, we're deluged with on a regular basis on the news. Do you think people have a general feel for what the issues are and where they exist?
I think it depends on where you live. So I don't know if you've traveled the Southwest at all.
Yes.
But they're very much aware that they live in a water scarce part of the world.
Yep. There's a lot of brown there on your map.
Yes. And I've spent some time driving from the Denver area south along the San Miguel mountain range. And every so often you'll see a sign, don't sell our water to Denver, because there's groundwater in that area that Denver has their eye on for solving some of their municipal supply issues. So people are very much aware that they live in water scarce area. I think what they're less aware about is that when we typically think of drought, we think of precipitation deficit. And now what's happening is drought in many parts of the world are being heat driven as opposed to precipitation driven. So yes, we still have precipitation deficits and surpluses, but when you combine that with hot weather, that amplifies both and effectively makes them worse. And so that's what we're beginning to see now. That's very different. And I think that's a less commonly understood an appreciated issue.
Sure. No, that makes perfect sense, because you think about it in terms of the lack of precipitation and not heat generally. So yeah, that does.
Heat makes plants thirstier, makes humans thirstier, and it evaporates out a lot of water from the topsoil.
And the curve on heat is going up, of course. Mm-hmm. So we're not looking at any relief from that in the near future.
Yeah, the other aspect that I think about, you know, everybody wants a Bitcoin. I tell folks probably one of the better investments in the future may be water. And, you know, what a lot of people don't understand, and I've spent quite some time understanding aquifers in the United States and across the world and who controls them. It is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, we don't sense it that much here in the East. But if you're out west and you look at where the aquifers are and who controls them, it's another discussion for us to have. And, you know, everyone that's listening, they can go and Google and do their own research. And in about 30 minutes, you come up with some rather obvious things to discuss. Do you have any comment on that, Tom?
The work you see most prominently on our website is what you sort of call the, you know, the physical characteristics of water. And of course, we don't experience water purely through those physical characteristics. It all gets mediated by legal and regulatory regimes, technologies for treatment and distribution and waste management. And that's the part that we as humans have the most direct control over, but it's also the most opaque in many ways. So I would challenge any of your listeners to come up with a global map that describes the legal regime for water in any given place. As far as I know, and I've looked pretty hard, such a map does not exist. And so even a good map for the United States is challenging because these regulations are highly diverse, I should say legal regimes are highly diverse and vary not just state by state or county by county, but municipality by municipality. And sometimes smaller units of analysis than that. And that's what mediates our access to this physical thing we call water. And it's poorly understood and is part of what really needs to change to get us to a better place.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, Tom, you know, I want to personally thank you for taking time today to discuss this with us. And I think we'll have some follow-up sessions as well. But thank you again. And Dan, thank you so much.
Sure. Yep. And we do recommend that our listeners go to isciences.com. That's all together, isciences.com. If you go to the blog page, there's a place where you can subscribe to the monthly water watch list, get an email periodically with some of this information in it. It's super interesting, and do recommend that people go there and take us up on that and look over the website. And I do thank you both for joining us today. Tom, thanks so much. And Myron, look forward to having the opportunity to bring this topic up again, because as you said, Myron, we could go on all day and many days about this. And I certainly look forward to talking about it some more.
Great. Have a good day, everybody.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, people. Thanks for joining us. I encourage you to come back and listen again to our next session of The Optimistic Investor.